Welcome, everyone. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Frank's going to come up and introduce our speaker tonight, who is coming back. It's been about 5 years. This is one of the things we do when we're staying sober. This man's sober.
I'm Frank Waters, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I'm going to try to get through this pretty quick. Speaking tonight, I met him about 23 years ago. Shaking. He was shaking. I mean, he was one of the alcoholics that visibly just shook. He just thought he had one of those rare diseases or something. And I couldn't hold a coffee. He could not look at me. He would find his feet if I looked in his direction. And he's come a long way. The broken person I used to see. And the guy I know today. After about 6 years of sponsoring myself, I asked this guy if he would walk with me. So for the past 8 years, he hadn't given up on me yet. And I love him. And I'm going to be quiet right now. So, Paulo.
Wow, what a nice surprise. I'm Paul, and I'm an alcoholic. I still have trouble looking at Frank. It terrifies me. We love each other a lot, and that's what happens. It's so nice to be back here. It has been 5 years of Thanksgiving week that I was here at this meeting. And I love what happens at a speaker meeting. Usually I'm sitting out there taking it in, but once in a while I get to get up and do this part of the sharing. And I heard what was read in the preliminary readings. The whole reason I'm here is to share my experience, strength, and hope. And it's like a snapshot of whatever it is tonight. There are some people in here who have heard my story once or twice. My wife is in the back with me. She's heard it about 15 times, and she's sort of my truth meter. If I start embellishing, I look at her and I see an eyebrow going up. I'm like, okay, bring it up. But let me start with the third step prayer, because that will sort of organize me about what I'm supposed to do. God, I offer myself to you to build with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do your will always. That kind of reminds me that I didn't get sober just so I could feel good and have a better life and, you know, have the amazing things that have happened to me for me, to me, that I began to develop at some point early in sobriety, the ability to actually have relationships with people that were actually based on the beginning rudiments of honesty and some of the other spiritual principles. And the way I did that is really not a secret, and it's funny, you know, people I work with know this is coming at some point whenever we're talking about something and, you know, we're swapping a list of problems and issues du jour. I'm always going to find a place to work in. Well, you know, there is an answer, and they always bite. And what's that? Well, it's the steps. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily, usefully whole. And that's really what's happened to me. It's an ongoing process. So I thought I'd do something a little bit different tonight, and I hope it works out. rather than do the chronological, you know, I was born at an early age, and then I'll sort of zip through that stuff. And then what I really want to talk about tonight is the steps, because I'm so intensely aware of them. So what this is not a lecture, this is not any of that stuff, but just share my experience of what got me into the steps and sort of the anti-steps that I practiced my whole life without knowing I was doing that. So I'm going to give that a try. I was born in 1952 in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is kind of a wealthy town, but a pattern that my family had was my dad was a school teacher, and in 1952 he had come back from the war. He was a war vet and got the GI Bill and went to Columbia and got his teaching stuff. But we weren't poor, but we were, you know, lower middle class, but we lived in these rich towns where he taught school. And we moved to a town way out on Long Island called Shoreham, which back in 1955 or 56 was way out in the country. Of course, people who've been to Long Island now know that there's hardly any country left there, but it was potato farms and Indian reservations, and we lived right on the North Shore. And so I had a black lab retriever dog. I had a bicycle. I had a bunch of friends. We went to the beach every day. I was a happy little kid. And still I'm affected by my circumstances. I'm not bulletproof. I'm affected by my environment. But there were no problems. I mean, I have an older sister, 4 years older than me, who we're closer than we've ever been. But when I first came home, she was kind of jealous. She still calls me Sonny Boy. There are probably some women in here who have brothers who were treated special, you know. But once she stopped trying to kill me when they first brought me home and decided I was there to stay, we got along. The parents seemed to get along. Something happened when I was pretty young, I think 6 or 7. My dad got a better job in another wealthy suburb closer into New York City, Scarsdale, New York. And he came and I think told my mom about it, and she was less than enthused. And my mom could really be kind of bitchy toward my dad. That was her method of conflict, to give him the silent treatment. And his was to, you know, dance around like his feet were on a hot skillet. So he had that conversation first, and then he said, I guess, he said, well, I'll go do something safe. I'll go tell my son, and I know my son will like this. And I pitched a fit, man. I didn't want to go to this strange place I'd never heard of and leave behind my friends and riding around playing games all day and swimming in the Long Island Sound. So I never pitched a fit. I wasn't apparently that kind of kid till that point. And he kind of lost it. And, you know, there was no defects level abuse that went on, but he really, his frustration, he took it out on me. And I made a conscious decision, I can remember it, I swear, like it just happened, that I was not going to ever show anybody again, ever, if I was upset, if I was angry, if I was afraid. And I was going to become a stoic. And I became a stoic. Well, something that happened at age 7, my dad was out mowing the lawn. I think he even had a push mower, and it was hot and humid. And he asked if I would go inside and get him a beer and a little Dixie cup. So I did that. But just for curiosity's sake, I'd never had a drink before that I remember. I poured a little in the cup and drank it. It was terrible cheap beer and a wax, you know, Dixie cup, tiny little ones, like a shot glass almost. And but I remember, again, like it was yesterday, this feeling went up to the top of my brain and spread like this warmth. It was just like, oh, I'm 7 years old. I don't know what this means, but I never forgot it. And in some ways, it seems like exaggerating. In some ways, the rest of my drinking was trying to recapture that moment of, and the doctor's opinion says that. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I guess I was impressionable at an early age. So my first drunk was at 13. We had moved to this other town, but I came back to spend the weekend with my friends from that town, Shoreham, and we borrowed. Technically, we stole, but somebody knew somebody who maybe owned the boat. We borrowed a boat and went out in rough water with a case of Drambuie. And 4 of us drank a case of Drambuie. And then ended up on the rocky beach, just absolutely vomiting. You know, you could feel your toenails come out your throat, that kind of stuff. And one person really didn't like it. And I've gone back and seen these people, actually. It's amazing. One person didn't like it, and he did the house picket fence, got a job, had a career, had a, you know, uneventful, fulfilling life. The other 3 of us, we were planning, okay, so what are we going to do next weekend? Whose parents are we going to steal what from? And one of those guys died of a heroin overdose at that magical age of 27, believe it or not. And then the other guy, who's still my lifelong best friend, who I see every 12 years, he got into recovery about 5 years before I did, and then me. So to me, the pattern was already set. It's kind of like starting to play out of hand. There are drugs in my story. I don't talk about, you know, how I ingested them or give any details, but it's an AA meeting, but it's me telling my story. So I discovered pot, and then I discovered in high school, I discovered hallucinogenic drugs, LSD, mescaline, all that stuff. Took a lot of those. My pattern tended to be find something and just take a lot of it, just to see what would happen, while also keeping a foot in home base while trying to... I started out in honors courses headed for advanced placement courses, and I ended up in my senior year with regular courses, and if I had another year, I'm sure I could have gotten down into remedial courses. But I was the classic underachiever. Oh, you have such potential. Oh, you're so... And to me, that sounded like so threatening. I couldn't stand it, and at the same time, I craved it. I had to have that attention, and I couldn't handle it. We have a signal in recovery that pretty much everybody understands in relationships or anything like that. It's like, come here, stay away, come here, stay away, come here, stay away. And so all my romantic relationships are like that, too. And not surprisingly, I tended to attract women who wanted to work on projects. I was a project. And the first woman in high school adopt me as a project was sort of like one of the rogue cheerleaders, because I had friends in all camps. It was important to me I not be in any camp, but I have friends in all camps. So I knew some of the jocks, but I wasn't really a jock. But she decided I'm going to hang out with this guy who disappears at lunch and alters his mind. And I was her project, and that didn't work out. And then another, I tended to be a serial monogamous. I went to school, I went to college, and went to a really tiny little hip, super hip, liberal college on the Hudson River called Bard College. People who've heard the song My Old School by Steely Dan, they went to Bard College, and the school they're never going to go back to again is Bard College. So I share that with them. And halfway through my second semester in the spring, it was springtime in upstate New York, the roads were muddy, the snow was yellow and brown, and ugh. And so my friend Zeb and I dropped out of school and hitchhiked across the country. And I didn't really tell anybody I was going to do that, including my parents. So they found out a few months later. I sent them a postcard from either San Francisco or L.A. or Phoenix or Portland or somewhere, and I kind of rattled around out there. But here's the funny thing about me. I am no rebel. I am so not a rebel. I could sort of stray off the reservation, but I had to keep a line open. So I had enough of that, and I told the parental units, okay, I've gotten these wild oats sown, I'm coming home. And so I moved back in, and I got a job driving a school bus. I was the only school bus driver with ponytail down to my ass who would have flashbacks, you know, while driving a bus full of kids on the New York State Thruway, but nobody died from it. I would pull over, Mr. Bus Driver, oh my God, there's lizards in my bus, you know, a bus full of lizards. But we got through that. And then I went to the school upstate New York where I would work hard, but not really. I mean, I was Mr., you know, cruise on your potential while not feeling good about that. But I just didn't really know or understand or believe in anything. And I'll get to some of what I discovered was going on a little bit later. But I was made to pick a major in my junior year with threat of expulsion, so I picked geology because I was taking a Rocks for Jocks course that was easy and fun. And so, of course, with zeal, now it's my junior year, I took all the geology courses and got a BS and got a fellowship to go to the University of Wyoming to get a master's. So I did that. And in Laramie, Wyoming, which is a fun, really little town, we're the only college in Wyoming, I was in the grad school and I was doing research by day or night, I don't know which was which, and then after a couple of days of that, I would go up to the top of the Laramie Range to this little saloon up there that was frequented by the one and only chapter of the Wyoming Hells Angels, and they adopted me as their sort of mascot. My nickname was the Professor. And so I would just show up there, and we would drink, and we would drug, and we would tell lies, and you know, the book says after a time we can't differentiate the false from the true. I was already there, but I was a grad student, so again, I kind of got it together at the last minute. I did well enough to get hired by an oil company, and went down to Houston, Texas to work for Shell Oil Company, which I was stuck in the 40th floor of a skyscraper in downtown Houston in an office by myself making geologic maps, which I didn't really understand, even though I had a master's in the damn subject. Didn't really care about. Would emerge once every week or two to have a meeting where I would present something to some VPs who all looked exactly the same in their gray or navy blue suits, and then would go back in my office and do more. Well, thank God for lunch hour, because right across the street from my skyscraper was a little Chinese restaurant bar that I called the recovery room. And so at lunchtime, I would go there at about 11:45, and after a little while, they knew my routine, and they would set up three double vodkas and a plate of egg rolls. That was my lunch, with some spicy mustard. And occasionally, I might order an extra drink if it had been a really rough morning. But I was already in the pattern of, I wasn't yet drinking in the morning. I wasn't yet drinking around the clock. But the few days where I didn't go for my lunch hour, my body didn't like that so well. And I'm now in my mid to heading toward late 20s. And that thing Frank talked about, which was severe, I had coarse tremors for a year. I was so shattered. But, you know, if I didn't drink, are you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. And I would find a way to go still that. It's hard to make a map when you're doing that. You know? So I'm sure I lied about it and said, well, that's actually how these rocks look. You know, they're all gone. Go figure. I mean, what caused that? That's amazing. We've discovered something here. I had, while I was in grad school, I had been dating a law student, and on a lark took the law boards and really didn't like what I was doing with rocks and oil. And so I decided to go to law school at night. So I did a job I didn't like during the day, and I went to law school at night. And by now I'm bringing thermoses with, you know, people brought food and they brought beverages. I brought, I called them killeritas, which are strong margaritas that you then poured vodka into. And that was what I did. I did a job I didn't like, went to class and drank, went home, studied enough in the weekends to get through, and somehow got through law school and somehow passed the bar exam. So now all the Perry Mason shows I watched as a young kid, now I hung out my own shingle, and I'm going to be a criminal defense lawyer, and I'm going to, you know, get innocent people off, and the guilty people, I'm going to make the state do what they're supposed to do and keep them on their A game and make everything right. And I did that for like four years, something like that. If you get the picture, I wasn't really well prepared. I wasn't like what you would call a button-down lawyer. Now I have the ponytail, not quite down to my ass, about halfway down, but I have the tan suit when you go to state court, because that's the state court color, or a navy suit when you go to federal court. And I won more than I lost, but I don't think I really knew what I was doing. But that's the story of my life. You know, now I act as if. Back then, I was madly faking it while pretending to be fine and not caring. And remember, I'm still a stoic. I'm not showing anybody. But by this time, after 2 decades or 3 decades of living like this, you can imagine what a seething cauldron of resentments I was. But people usually didn't dare to talk to me about that. But when they would, you know, there would be such a bristle of like lava about to come on them that most people would back off, and if they wouldn't, I would leave. Because that was also my pattern when I started to hear the posse coming once or twice, it really made me angry, or it would have if I allowed myself to admit to being angry, where someone in a relationship would see what was going on and she would leave first. That was, I mean, I'm supposed to be the one that leaves. I'm the project. I'm the guy working on being a magnificent loner. I want you, but I don't really need you. How can you possibly pack up all your stuff so when I come home Friday night, the whole apartment's empty except for my guitars and my liquor, which was basically what I had. She did leave a mattress on the floor. That was kind of it. So this is how my life is going. And I flew back east to do Christmas, I think, with my family in my sister's house down in Maryland. And my family really, you're not doing so good. But, of course, I bristled. No, I'm just, it's rough right now. But so flying back, I met the newest woman of my dreams on the airline flight. And we had a couple of drinks together and did a couple of drugs together and whatever. And I agreed New Year's Eve would be great. Would you go out with me New Year's Eve? Oh, I'd love to go out with you New Year's Eve. Well, I made it from Houston almost over to San Antonio, where she lived, where I got arrested in a town called Seguin in Guadalupe County, where unfortunately is a in Texas they call it DWI, but DUI, same thing, attorney with two cases in that court, so you can imagine. And the guy who arrested me was a Texas State Police guy who I had cross-examined a couple times and once made look not so good, and my guy got off. He was really excited to see me that New Year's Eve when he pulled me over and I wheeled the window down. And I blamed it on the fact that I drank something I don't usually drink. I drank hot mulled wine at the office party where I was sort of in a lawyer's co-op. If I had only stuck with vodka, my life would have been totally different. I wouldn't be here. But he, you know, so my one phone call, I got to call her at 3 a.m. and say, could you get together some bail money and come? So she bailed me out in wearing the little black dress, you know, the New Year's little black dress. And so, of course, within a couple of months, I was engaged to her. And I had to give up practicing the law because I started having anxiety and once even a panic attack at a little thing, a motion hearing. I'd done like 1,000 motion hearings by this time. And down in Galveston, Texas, I walked to the door of the courtroom, and I couldn't go in. And I did, you know, you already know the answer to this. When confronted with the dilemma of you can't drink and practice law, which one's going to go? The law. So I called up all my lawyer friends and gave away all my cases. And then my family did an intervention on me, and they said, a phone intervention. Things were not wonderful down in San Antonio with Gretchen. We were kind of like, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf? Throwing stuff, yelling, arguing, which I've really never been in any other relationship. But I was just totally whacked out on alcohol, and she smoked dope all day long at work and then came home and smoked dope. So we were both two really clear-thinking, upright citizens, deeply in love with each other, trying to work it out. And so I said, okay, I'll come home. I'll just come home and get my act together. And so I took like a four-day Greyhound bus ride from San Antonio through Tennessee. And it was not the express. It was the local in the middle of the summer with the air conditioning broken. And I didn't drink for like 4 days. So when I showed up in the New York Port Authority on what turned out to be the hottest or second hottest day of the summer of that year, I was like a mess. But it was okay. My dad said, you have to go to AA. He told me that 2 days after I got home and had drank all his liquor in 2 days. And he said, that's a condition, and we didn't want to tell you because we thought you wouldn't come, but you're really going to have to go to AA. So I went to AA. The kicker is that I did go to AA, but I didn't stop drinking. But I didn't tell anybody that I was still drinking. I would periodically stage a relapse where, oh, God, you relapse, but you're back, keep coming back. And if there's anybody who's going through this, there's nothing wrong with it. We all have our own stories. At this point, somebody who I think was an honest little kid, whose mother just drilled into him, you got to give back, you got to do for people, you got to be honest, and I agree, yeah, ma. I was lying to everybody. I was lying to my father, the man who had reached out to me and had me come back home. And you know what? I have to say, I wasn't even really breaking a sweat at that point because I was an alcoholic so far gone into my active alcoholism that I was protecting myself. This was survival. I was like a fish who's being told, no water for you. I mean, or a human being told, no oxygen for you. That's what alcohol had become for me. When I would go very long without it, my body and mind and everything would scream at me. And I had nothing else. I had the achievements were modest. They had been bigger. They had gone away. But you know what? Any of the achievements, none of the degrees, none of the relationships with some really wonderful women, none of it ever really filled that hole inside me. And I know we all know what that is. You may have your own version or name for it, but that hole in our soul. And so one month I forgot to do my stage phony relapse, and I hadn't looked around, and all of a sudden a year had come up, and they said, oh, this is the Hartsdale-Ardsley group up in New York where Bill Wilson used to go sometimes to get away from the city. He'd tool up there with Lois. She'd probably go to an Al-Anon meeting or whatever. And so this group had been around a long time, wonderful people, huge group. They said, oh, 1 year, it's so awesome, it's so great. And I couldn't figure out how to get out of this lie. I just got caught in it. So my sister flew in from out of town and carried a cupcake room with about 200 people, lights down, Saturday night, church basement, classic. And carried this cupcake up to me, and on the ride home, my dad said, "You normally can talk pretty well. You were kind of, I was overcome with emotion. I was overcome with this feeling of empty, despairing, disgust, and I didn't know how to stop it or get off of it. So my job, I was still working for Shell, but instead of working for corporate Shell, wearing a suit, finding oil, I was wearing a brown Shell uniform, pumping gas in Central Avenue in Yonkers, New York. And I got promoted to manager because I could sell jobs, get under Mrs. Johnson's hood. And, oh, those fan belts are a little frayed, Mrs. Johnson. You might need to replace those so you don't get stuck on the Cross Bronx Expressway while they strip your car and maybe kidnap you. And okay, I'll take the fan belts. But people like me. You know, just like when I was a lawyer, they like me. They believe me. So Mr. Living a Lie was, I never sold a job that didn't almost need to be done. I could see it coming. That belt's going to go. So after that, you would think that would be the end of days when I did that. Living a Lie was like, in a lot of ways, the worst night of my life, but I wasn't done yet. New Year's Day of that year, I told everyone working the gas station, a couple of them really wanted to work. I said, no, you guys, you've been working too hard. You need to take a vacation. What I really wanted to do was not have anything to do with my family, my father. I couldn't look him in the face anymore. And I went to that gas station, and it was a classic snowstorm, not the soft, warm snow, but sort of driving snow, whipping my face. And I just drank all day. At this point, my half gallon a day was beginning to be not quite enough. And then, you know, this is like January turned to February, and then March, the end of February came, and I was supposed to go back down to Texas to take some courses to get my law license current, like I was going to go do that again. But I kept it going, and I had everything bought and paid for, and then my dad said he wanted a vacation. I think he knew I was lying, but he couldn't say it, and I couldn't say it, and it was like killing him. And so he and his girlfriend went somewhere like Sedona or something. And I didn't go to Texas. I drove around Westchester County and bought all the vodka I could buy. And two, I didn't want to show bad form, 2 half gallons at every store. So I went to a lot of liquor stores in Westchester County, did the old trick where you may know this, where in the morning if you're buying something, your hand's shaking like that, so embarrassing. You just sort of hold the bag and you say, just throw the change in the bag. Made up lies about, you know, I'm buying this for a party, we're having this party. I think at some place I said football, even though it was like the end of February or March. They knew exactly what they were dealing with, but they sold me the alcohol. And what I did was I went home. Two of my favorite song lines, let me throw these in here, because they're important to me now from a different angle, from sobriety. Tom Petty in King's Highway has a line saying, I don't want to end up in a room all alone. I don't want to end up someone I don't even know. Ryan Adams in his new album, I think the song Trouble has a song, we might as well be dead and gone if we don't belong. That's how I was. I was my alcoholic loner's prayer had finally been answered. I'd engineered it, so I was in my dad's house all by myself. At some point, I called up and quit the gas station job in a blackout. And me, like a lot of us, the last thing to go is the job. Relationships are gone. But I'm working. You know, I'm okay. I'm functional. I just drank and I drank and I drank and I drank, and it was around the clock. I'm guessing it was a gallon a day. It just never stopped. But I'm really grateful for this now. There was no buzz left. There was no anesthesia. There was no joy. There was nothing except for just drink to avoid going to physical withdrawal, which my body, I'd never done it. My body was letting me know in advance, this is going to majorly suck. You cannot do this. You have to keep drinking. And I just rattled around. I had TVs on all floors. And I do remember Robert Schuller, the elder, one Sunday had a sermon, which amazingly was targeted toward alcoholics. And I don't know this guy in real life. I don't know if he's a big money-grubbing phony. That morning, I looked at him, and it was like he was coming out of the TV because I was already beginning to hallucinate. But at least I wasn't seeing lizards on a school bus. I was seeing Robert Schuller saying, you'll be all right. You can be all right. There's help. And so at some point, I was sitting on top of the stairs in the tracksuit. I hadn't changed for like 7 or 8 days. And the first step took me. I never took the first step. The first step took me, and I think it's a God thing myself. I think I was spared. I hadn't fallen down and broken my neck or aspirated on my own vomit or hung myself or shot myself or any of the ways the alcoholics, we die that way, by accident or design. And I just said, I can't do this, and I don't know how not to do it, which is really both parts of the first step. And I felt this tiny little glimmer of hope. So I crawled back into my bed. I don't think I'd eaten any food that whole time. Not to be graphic, but I was still throwing up. There was nothing to throw up, so my liver decided to cooperate with a little bile. Oh, what's that green stuff? And so I was just doing that, and my father came home at some point, called his minister, who was a young guy I really had liked, and he came, and nobody was being punitive. He told my AA sponsor, who was my father's best friend. The guy had like 27 years when I first met him. He was still working with slogans. He hadn't worked the steps yet, but he was sober. He told me later on, he said, Paul, everyone, your family loves you. God loves you. Maybe someday you can learn to love you. But everybody was just there for me. And I went into the detox when a bed opened up, and I was already going into DTs. And they called the code, and they got me up there. And that same place I had gone when I was in AA and still drinking but lying about it, and even led some meetings, even led a third step meeting up there while reeking of rum or vodka. I was actually on the other end of it now, and I was just, they could see I was broken, but I was so hungry for this thing. I just knew I have to do this thing. I have to have this thing. And that little flicker of hope was all I had. It was like a pilot light that never quite went out. For me, I describe that as that's still voice within. That's the God spot within. When I said, I don't know how to not do this, step two, which I had heard through the alcoholic haze and all those meetings, began to sort of remind me it was there. You know, there's a power greater than you that can, if not restore you to sanity. I had no hope of that, but at least get you through this next little patch. And it was really second to second, minute to minute. They recommended I come down to Georgia, to Decatur, Georgia, to Decatur Hospital, which in the early 90s had a pretty up-and-humming recovery program. And Atlanta was like Recovery Central back then. Those were around that long. Now there was like bookstores and halfway houses on every block. Well, there still are in some blocks, but it was just like recovery was in the air, and it was springtime. My sobriety date, by the way, is March 20th, 1991, so the first day of spring. I did not plan that, sitting in that house, you know, falling apart. Oh, this will be a good day to stop. My life began turning around down here. So really the first step, early on, I bought and listened to with some other people the original Joe and Charlie tapes. If you haven't heard those, they're pretty hardcore fundamental, but they make a lot of sense. And they said that step one by itself is the problem, step two is the answer, and the rest of the steps are the way we you know, get that solution into our lives. And that's turned out to be true for me. Now, I'm also a recovering intellectual. You know, I lived out of my brain, the stoic who wasn't in touch with his feelings at all. And you know, why should I ever want to get experiential wisdom? I wanted to do speculative head knowledge. I had been an expert on many topics that I actually knew nothing about. And, well, I was a lawyer, right? Yeah. And that's, by the way, a chronic disease. You never recover from that. It's like malaria. I have outbreaks of lawyerness sometimes. But step two and then step three, that was the one that I was still trying that one when I was in treatment, walking around asking people, how do you do step three? And they would give me these answers like, easy does it. And I thought they were blowing me off. I thought they were, you know, not answering my question and disrespecting me. And finally, the time I knew I'd done it was when I was asked to read at the AA meeting down in the cafeteria there. And it, like this, it had a microphone. I'm not a huge fan of mics. But my voice was quivering like a sheep on helium and terror. And the podium had loose nails, deliberately, I think, so we could hear the noise. And I was up there hyperventilating, going, of course, which reading did they give me? How it works. Yeah. But I hung in there and I did it. Every part of the old me wanted to get out of there. Just survive. This is deadly. And I hung in there. And afterwards, when people opened their eyes, it was like, one guy said later, it was looking like the slowest train car wreck ever. Just they were peering through their eyes. Is he going to make it? Is he going to live? Oh, my God. And somebody said that was step three. You decided to hang in there when because you thought it was the right thing. Step four, I'd never, ever looked at myself honestly, let alone taking a searching and fearless moral inventory. I was somebody who said, I don't have any resentments. Because that's like admitting, you know, the Stoic doesn't have resentments. I have stoical thoughts about things. When I started writing that list, column one, that way where, well, just write down one or two. Just put a name down. It was like somebody opened the dam and whoosh. 8 pages later, I need some more paper. I have more resentments. But I've been through the steps several times. And, you know, that journey from column one over to column four, where I began to look at what's my part, which I wasn't very good at first, I'm still doing through step 10. And occasionally when I have to write it down, I do that. But what started out is constantly finding myself having done things wrong and needing to go make amends, which at first, of course, was apologizing and then continuing to do the same stuff in slightly different versions. That was really the way out of victimhood and out of no power into real power, because now over in column four and column three, what feelings did I have about that? And column four, what was my part? What did I do, not do, say, not say? That's where my power lies. That's what I can change. That's the courage to change pile and the serenity prayer. There's the power. Oh, my God, all this powerlessness. I never knew where my power was. My power is to see what I'm really doing and see how that affects other people and then do something to change that. Six and seven to me are really the fuel I run off of. This is weird. I'm making myself sound saintly. Believe me, I'm not. But my conscious thoughts throughout the day are to do 10, 6, 7, and the last part of 12. 10, I see something going on. Usually I see my own symptom first. I've gotten better at actually seeing me first before what's wrong with everyone else. So I can still do that pretty quickly. Come up with a real thorough indictment like in about 2 seconds. But I see what's my part. And then 6 and 7. 6 is just what am I doing here that I need to let go of that's a self-centered thing that I think I need to do to be okay. And then 7, even if I don't know what it is, where can I go find out some way to do this differently and more aligned with God's will? Because I began to discover that God's will is not some empty, pious thing. When I'm actually in alignment with my conception of God's will, I'm actually having a better life. I'm enjoying it more. I'm not a martyr. I'm not doing without. I'm actually in this interactive thing with people called a relationship. Oh, my God, this is what a relationship is. 8 and 9, 8 is just recopy step 4, right? But I had halfway house zealot that I was. Captain Recovery was my nickname. I had burned my 4-step in the backyard of the halfway house. And then I was like, oh, God, I have to think of that stuff again. So I wrote it down again. And then I discovered in step 8 how hard-hearted I'd been my whole life. I think I'm a nice guy. I think even back then I was a nice guy. If you slighted me, and a slight, it also counts as a slight, if you gave me some love, but it wasn't as much as I expected or you should have given me, or you gave me yesterday because, God forbid, you were tired or preoccupied or thinking about something else, I never forgot that. And my heart was so hardened. And when I saw that, that was a real pivotal moment because that was horrible to see. OMG. I've been this hard-hearted, seething, dishonest, stoic person who so desperately wants to connect and belong and love and be loved and has no idea how to do it. But I was told by my sponsor who had a very similar experience, it's okay. That's how we are when we get here. This is a process that you're being transformed. So just keep doing it. 9, my 30-day amends to my sister for the 3 o'clock in the morning phone calls, drunken, saying, I've discovered the secret. I'm going to take a bartending class and emigrate to Australia. Click, And so 30 days in the treatment center, I call, oh, God, I'm so sorry. Click. It took a while. It took a while with my dad, who was so deeply hurt. But he would come down to Atlanta every spring, actually, coincidentally, during the time of my birthday, and he would come to my home group meeting, the 7:30 early morning study group with my wife, and they'd say, you want to say a few words? My dad was like, give me that mic. Oh, well, if you want me to. And he would just marvel at what AA was in general and then what it had done for his son. We got his son back in a way, way more than we ever had each other before when we were close, back before he gave me that good news about moving to Scarsdale. So 10, 11, I mean, just deepen it, deepen it. I want to end with this because step 12, I'm never done with the steps. I'm always doing it, but I always have to read this because it just inspires me so much from page 124, 125, and the 12 and 12. This is what we get. It starts and always includes don't take a drink today, this hour, this minute, because otherwise for me all bets are off. And some days that's about as good as I could do, and there's still some days when I'm thinking, you know, all this stuff is happening, I'm not taking a drink, I'm just going to be satisfied with that and be grateful for that. But doing these other things on top of that can lead to this. Still more wonderful is the feeling that we do not have to be specially distinguished among our fellows in order to be useful and profoundly happy. Not many of us can be leaders of prominence, nor do we wish to be. Service gladly rendered, obligations squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help, the knowledge that at home or in the world outside we are partners in a common effort, the well understood fact that in God's sight all human beings are important, the proof that love freely given surely brings a full return, the certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons, the surety that we need no longer be square pegs and round holes but can fit in and belong in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could possibly be substitutes. And here it comes. Here's my other piece of my daily fuel, because I am still a very ambitious guy. I want to live. I want to live deeply and richly and love and do all those things. True ambition is not what we thought it was. True ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. So that is what I plan on continuing to do, and to do that I'm going to keep coming back, and I hope I see all of you in this sunlight of the fellowship of the Spirit in which we live. Thank you.
As Speedy Moore used to say, that was marvelous. Daniel, can I hand out the chip?
My name is Daniel. I'm an alcoholic. Here at this meeting, at the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting, we do have chips to mark our time in sobriety. If you are wanting to give this a shot just for today, we offer a white chip. Does anybody want to pick up a white chip tonight? Yeah. After 30 days and 30 nights. Kept it on a shelf.
to someone else. Sleep.